And I'm McKenna.
And together we're the Daily Profcast.
We're two long-distance besties
who share a love of Harry Potter.
We hope you enjoy the episode.
Welcome back to the Daily Profcast. And before we get started with any Harry Potter things, we all need to wish McKenna a very, very happy birthday. Today, well, when you hear this on Thursday, it will no longer be her birthday. So if you missed it, you can wish her a belated birthday. But today, Sunday, the day we're recording, is her 26th birthday. Happy birthday! Did you have an awesome birthday weekend?
Yes, I did. It was a really fun birthday weekend, especially because last year's birthday occurred in the midst of like the worst part of the pandemic. So it was definitely nice to just like be able to go outside and like eat outside and celebrate and just like so many nice well wishes from people. And I like birthdays. Birthdays are fun.
Birthdays are fun. You're really good at doing other people's birthdays. I have some surprises coming for you. The package, I suppose, would have been here on the day if your birthday wasn't on a Sunday. I suppose it'll get there tomorrow. Oh. And then tonight, there's a little thing I have to show you after we record.
Oh.
Yeah. So anyway, so we're going to do a little birthday episode, and then we'll be on a little TikTok live. If you're listening to this Thursday, you will have missed it, but hopefully you see us on TikTok.
So tonight. Because it's my birthday, am I allowed to talk about Snape as much as I want to today?
Sure. And there's a really, really good Snape chapter in here. So yes, I will allow it.
So excited.
So today we're doing chapters 24, 25, 26.
Yep. So 24 is
Rita Skeeter's scoop.
Right. So I guess before we kind of get into the plot points of this chapter, within the first couple of paragraphs, it is mentioned that Hermione is using Sleeky's hair potion. And I highlighted it in my book because Harry doesn't know this. And I'm curious if Hermione knows this, being the kind of scholar that she is. Mm-hmm. But this hair potion was invented by Harry's grandfather.
On his father's side, yep. Fleamont Potter, the inventor of Sleeky's hair potion.
Right. And so the Potters were sort of like prolific inventors of potions. It's kind of like what their family's known for. And
yeah, going all the way back to the 12th century, the Potters have been like, there have been a lot of potioneers in the Potter family.
Which is funny considering how not great at potions Harry is.
Absolutely. It's hilarious. I highlighted that too. Glad you caught that.
Yeah, I thought it was really cute. So the chapter sort of opens up. I think Harry is kind of frustrated about the egg.
Yes.
And we have to remember that Cedric has just given him like pretty sage advice on how to open up the egg and get the clue for the next challenge.
As repayment for when Harry told him about the dragons.
Right.
It's like, but let me help you.
Harry is so blinded by how much he hates Cedric because he's dating Cho that he can't like put it aside and just take the advice, figure out the next task and like conceive a plan to help him get through. And I just wrote a note in my book that's like, perhaps this is why people who are younger than 17 like shouldn't be competing in this. You know, it's just like he just so 14 years old, 15 years old, so clearly like lacks the maturity necessary to get through this on his own and like do well.
He almost never gets through any of this tournament on his own, despite the fact that one of the rules is you have to do all of this by yourself.
Right. And to be fair, many of the other champions are also not doing this on their own. I think Rick might be the only one who's really genuinely going at this, except for the tip that Harry gave him.
Which is really commendable considering, you know, Karkaroff and Madame Maxime are kind of doing everything they can for their own champions. Harry sort of gets to phone friends. And as far as we know, Cedric is using all of his own intellect, you know, and abilities to get through it.
It just shows how immature teenagers are to me, this whole bit. And it's so frustrating because everybody's trying to make sure that Harry does well in this tournament, right? Like Hermione wants to be giving him support. Ludo Bagman wants to give him support. I mean, for selfish, contrived reasons, as we're to find out later. But Harry is just kind of lying to everybody, saying he's already figured out the task. It's going to be fine. And all this time, he's just sitting on this like major clue and just flying by the seat of his pants.
Yeah.
It's just, it just was incredibly frustrating for me to read.
Yep. Yep. It is. But like, would you have done anything different at that age? Maybe you.
Well, I'm an Enneagram 1, so winning is very important to me.
Yes. I'm an Enneagram 2. I'm very emotional. And I probably would have been a little bit more like Harry. Well, I'm going to do it on my own because you're dating the person I like. Meh, meh, meh.
Yeah.
Which is petty, but.
I mean, of course, you always want to say that like you are better than like the thing that frustrates you. So probably not would I have done anything different.
But no, I think you would. I think you would. I think you would have taken it.
I will say like winning is very, I'm very competitive.
Yes, you are. I've played Mario Kart with you so many times. Lego, Star Wars, everything.
Yeah, I'm pretty competitive. Yes. I can admit it. Yeah.
Yeah. So
yeah.
Did we get to the article?
Yes.
So hearkening back to chapter 23, when Harry and Ron accidentally overheard a conversation between Hagrid and Madame Maxime, where Hagrid mentioned that he was half giant and there was a beetle on the ground. Harry was trying to distract himself with this beetle because he felt bad that he was overhearing this conversation. Well, somehow Rita Skeeter has caught wind of this conversation and has published a pretty damning article about Hagrid and Dumbledore specifically like hiring a half giant because there's this big stigma against giants just being like bloodthirsty, murderous creatures. It's very, very much like the treatment of Hagrid in this chapter and the stigma surrounding him being half giant and the writing in this article is very, very much like what we saw Professor Lupin go through a little bit in the last book, or what we know of like the conversation on werewolves from the last book. Just like this general prejudice against other creatures or beings that aren't, you know, your typical normal wizard person.
Right.
It's very sad.
And we kind of see, you know, that after they've read this article and digested it, Ron is sort of like, well, yeah, half giants are terrible. Like they're brutal. Yeah. And Hermione says, well, come on. They said the same thing about Professor Lupin when they found out he's a werewolf. It's just bigotry. And I underlined in my book the use of the word bigotry because it's so ironic that this author uses that word and takes the stance, but displays so much bigotry in her own views towards others. And it's just funny with perspective and age, how I used to think this book was like such a rallying cry for social justice. And now I'm like, oh, I don't know about that.
Yeah, absolutely. It is ironic. Ron is, again, where he was sort of, Ron sort of acts as our like representative as somebody who grew up in a wizarding household into like typical wizarding views on
right.
Social issues like this. So he, as soon as he found out Lupin was a werewolf, he was like cowering from him. Now he's like, you know, yeah, giants are bad. It's a well-known fact. He sort of is this, like, has this attitude with house elves. He's Ron is our glimpse into like the general wizarding world opinions on these sort of social issues.
Yeah, he's our wizard guide.
Yeah.
Because everything in this book is from Harry's perspective. And then, of course, Hermione was raised by two muggles. So neither of them understand these like sort of very specific cultural ingrained thoughts and ideals in the same way that Ron can understand them. And we're going to see it kind of like throughout, because there's just places, something that comes to mind is like in the 7th book/movie when he's like, oh, Babbity Rabbit, Babbity yeah. Rabbity. Like he just has a different perspective because of how he was raised. And I still always think it's very interesting the prejudices that Ron does have, considering that we would view the Weasleys as some of the more sort of liberal
quote-unquote in terms of like families. Blood status. Yeah.
In terms of how they accept others and blood status and all of that.
Right. And I do wonder, I'm like, I don't know that the rest of the people in his household necessarily share these views, and if he's just repeating, you know, things he hears from the general populace. Because, like, I don't think Charlie Weasley, you know, lover of dragons, would necessarily look at somebody who's a werewolf or a half giant and be like, you are immediately evil, you know, like.
Right. And what's so funny is, I guess I just always, like, wouldn't it be quite obvious that Hagrid's a half giant? Like,
yeah, Harry's, Harry's sort of not surprised.
Like, and, aren't this tall.
Yeah. And that, right. And exactly. And then there's a mention later of, this is, you know, jumping quite ahead, but when they're in Hagrid's hut later, there are so many, Dumbledore says there are so many parents who have written these letters to him in support of Hagrid, being like, because Hagrid has been at Hogwarts at least since Harry's parents and the Marauders were in school.
Right.
Ron's parents would have had a person named, because remember, Hagrid went to school when Tom Riddle was there. So in the 40s, and then when he was expelled and then later hired, he was at first like an apprentice to the current, like the groundskeeper at the time, whose name was Og. And that's who, like, Molly mentions him. That's like who Molly and Arthur and their generation remember. But the generations following that at Hogwarts all had Hagrid. That is what, 20 years of other students?
All had him on campus as the groundskeeper.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not as a professor. That was obviously recent.
Yes.
To the,
yes.
These
yeah.
Things.
The keeper of keys and grounds at Hogwarts.
This is just, I don't know. The whole thing is really sad. It's very, I don't know. Rita Skeeter's the worst.
She is the worst. She grinds.
And Hagrid also so naive, because some of the things quoted are from an interview that Hagrid had with Rita Skeeter.
And they were taken out of context.
They were taken so grossly out of context. And it's just, I think it just shows that Hagrid's so nice and just like so friendly to everybody. He doesn't like, he never views people and sees them as having bad intentions. Like he always tells the kids, like, Professor Snape would never try and hurt you. He's a professor here. You know, he always just gives people the benefit of the doubt. And in this case, it just like really came to bite him.
Yeah. Yeah, he is very trusting, almost to a fault. I did forget, now Hagrid's gone for like a week because of this article.
I forgot about this other professor.
I was just going to say, I forgot about Professor Grubbly Plank. Great name.
What house do we think Rita Skeeter's in? Because I don't think we have a canon answer.
I believe that. We do, and I think she was a Slytherin. I'm going to look it up.
I mean, it makes sense.
Yes.
Like, unfortunately for my house. But
well, she's like very
ambitious.
She'll do anything to like get ahead.
Cunning.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. She is cunning. She's very cunning. She's incredibly smart and strategic about the way she like gets her information for her articles.
And she obviously reaches out to other Slytherins, you know, for advice.
While there is no canon answer, most people seem to think Ravenclaw or Slytherin. Okay, so I was probably remembering Fannin. Most of the fandom agrees that she's probably Slytherin, but also she's not a very, like, she's not a character we would necessarily call good. And most people tend to immediately group characters that aren't, like, the hero or the protagonist into Slytherin. So,
right,
but I could see Ravenclaw too.
I could see that, but I definitely think she has the cunning sort of personality and drive and ambition that is very commonly associated to Slytherin.
Yes.
But like, it's sort of like the Enneagram, right? I kind of look at the houses in the same way, where there's like the house at its healthiest and then there's like the house at its unhealthy point. And unfortunately, I think Slytherin is always displayed in an unhealthy light until we meet Slughorn. And even then, like, teeters a very fine line, because they essentially tell us that he like helped Tom Riddle figure out about Horcruxes.
Right. And then like the way later houses, we learn about Andromeda and what Regulus did at the end. And yeah.
But then like all the other houses are primarily portrayed in like a very healthy light.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, I mean, I think there are some characters that we would view as antagonists that I think, you know, if we didn't already know their canon house, or if we don't already know their canon house, I'm like, you could be a Hufflepuff because you're super loyal, just not for the side that we would deem, you know, good.
Right. I've seen a lot of interesting writings at how Bellatrix could have been a Hufflepuff.
I don't know that I agree with that, but
I think it's interesting. I mean, I don't know that Bellatrix so much wanted to get ahead and like achieve greatness so much as she wanted to be extremely loyal to Voldemort.
Well, the thing with Hufflepuff is not, you know, their key like common trait that we associate them with is loyalty, but they're also really just and fair. So I see like the sort of lawful, some of the, like, you know, you've got your chaotic good, lawful good, neutral good, chaotic evil, you know, I see some of the like lawful evil characters, like you could have maybe been in Hufflepuff because you're so hellbent on justice, just not necessarily in the way that most people would view as, you know, going in the direction of good or righteousness.
Like Dolores Umbridge, is that?
Yeah, it is. But I actually think Umbridge's canon house is Slytherin.
I do think it's Slytherin. But again, she's very loyal to the ministry, very loyal to Fudge, and she's right. All about the...
Right, she's not like... I wouldn't necessarily call her...
She's not a climber.
Right. I don't think she's very happy to like serve under the minister and like...
Right. She's proud to be the undersecretary. Like that is something she wears, versus I think somebody in Slytherin would want so desperately to move beyond that position.
Right. So I think Umbridge, like, she's all about, you're right, she's all about rules and structure.
Like, I don't think Narcissa Malfoy or Narcissa Black is necessarily like a natural Slytherin either.
Actually,
because I don't see her as a climber in any sort of way. I mean, I think she enjoyed the status she naturally had, but she's much more about family and deep loyalty to her family.
Right. Whereas Bellatrix, I don't know that that's necessarily her defining trait. She's loyal to her for sure.
Chaotic evil. I don't even know that she belongs in like any house.
If anything,
she should have been homeschooled.
I was going to say, if anything, Bellatrix strikes me as a really
Gryffindor?
Crazy, unhinged Gryffindor.
Yeah, I totally can see that.
For the, just the like...
Like believing she has so much bravery and valor and that she's like very boastful and...
Yeah, just like...
Crazy,
you know, does energy. Without thinking. And yes, so that's my weird hot take that I'm probably going to get hate for.
In sort of like... It's very annoying to me in canon that like families are constantly grouped together in houses.
Right, we've had this conversation with Percy.
Right, but there's so many other Weasleys that I don't know necessarily just belong in Gryffindor. I don't know that all of them just are naturally Gryffindors.
If we can traverse into Cursed Child for a second, Scorpius Malfoy is 0% a Slytherin.
No, not even a little 0%. Bit of Slytherin.
He's only in Slytherin because he's a Malfoy.
Right, and it's just frustrating that that's how it went. Like, I think Lucius Malfoy quite obviously is Slytherin.
Oh.
But I don't know that I think, well, I mean, obviously the Black Sisters, I don't think that all three of them are just naturally. And then it's like when somebody diverges from their family and their house,
serious?
Then they're sort of like the hero because they've like broken from the evil people.
Right.
And like Sirius is very obviously a Gryffindor. I think that house fits him pretty well.
Yeah.
But it's like it's his house is what sets him apart from his family, not necessarily their values.
Right. And then, yeah, we could talk about this all day. And, we could then introduce the topic of conversation on how there's like a theory in the fandom that what house you get placed into isn't necessarily what traits you have, but what traits you value. Which that sort of turns the tables even more. But anyway, yeah, it's really house placement can be very disappointing, especially with Slytherins and just like, oh, you're like a morally gray or evil character, automatically a Slytherin.
Not for nothing, I think Dumbledore could have been a Slytherin.
Oh, yeah. He wasn't in canon, but
no,
probably should have been. Yeah, could have. Yeah, absolutely. So...
Anyway.
they have a substitute in Care of Magical Creatures, Professor Grubbly Plank.
Can we talk about how rude Harry is to her off the bat? Like,
well, I don't know that he's necessarily... It's coming across as rude, but it's...
Can I just read the sentence?
Sure, maybe I'm forgetting it.
I was just like, Harry, oh my goodness.
I mean, he's concerned for Hagrid, and it probably comes across as... He's very sassy.
So she says, hurry up now. The bell rang 5 minutes ago. She barked at them as they struggled towards her through the snow. Who are you? Said Ron, staring at her. Where's Hagrid? My name is Professor Grubbly Plank. Great name. I am your temporary care of magical Creature's teacher. "Where's Hagrid?" Harry repeated loudly. "He is indisposed," said Professor Gribbley Plank. Soft and pleasant laughter reached Harry's ears, and then he
finds out about the article.
Right. And then he says, "What's wrong with Hagrid?" "Never you mind." "I do mind, though," said Harry hotly. "What's up with him?" I'm just like, is that how you speak to a teacher?
Especially when you don't know. Yeah, maybe not necessarily.
I don't know. His demeanor towards her just kind of bothered me. I know. Yeah, sassy and Harry is like such a vibe all the time. But
yeah, but she did nothing to deserve that. That was the correct, you know, diplomatic teacher response.
Oh, it's just totally not appropriate for her to be like, "Oh, you want to know what's happening with Hagrid? Like, let me tell you." And again, this is just because people in Harry's life don't set proper boundaries with him. So I think that it's difficult for him to recognize them when he encounters them.
Yeah.
He's also 14. So.
Yeah, correct. So Hagrid has holed himself up in his cabin and he isn't leaving. They don't see him till the end of the week. The next week, I suppose, because there's a Hogsmeade trip that weekend and Harry does not go with the cloak and Hermione's kind of chastising him, being like, you know, "Have you made progress on your egg? You should probably just take this time to go sit in your dorm, like while it's quiet, and go try and figure out the egg." And he's like, "No, I want to, you know, want to get out of the castle." Go to Hogsmeade, they go to Three Broomsticks, and Ludo Bagman is having a conversation with some goblins.
Yes.
And it looks very serious. And apparently, I don't know how this is a conversation. Like, goblins can speak English.
Yes.
Like, they can speak, like, the tongue of the wizards at Gringotts, but it's like, there's a mention of, like, they were just speaking gobbledygook, which is the goblin language, and using, like, hand signs. So that makes no sense. Unless these are, like, non-Gringotts
goblins
who don't.
Oh, that's true. I didn't really consider that.
Yeah, I didn't consider that when I was reading. That just popped
love
in my head.
Love when I think on the fly.
Yeah, me too. Yeah, so he's talking to the goblins. He looks kind of stressed out. And then he sees Harry and he walks up to Harry and two important things. He offers to help Harry cheat with the egg and Harry turns it down. Harry's like, "No, thanks. I don't want your help." But he'll accept help from his friends, but not from Ludo Bagman. It seems, I mean, he's not supposed to accept help from anyone, but it seems extra sketchy that
one of the judges
is offering to help him cheat, but he's, we're going to learn later that he's got a stake in the competition.
Yeah. Big stake.
Yeah. And then the second thing is Ludo reveals that Barty Crouch Sr. has like been missing from work and nobody really knows where he is. He's been sick and he stopped showing up to work. And his whereabouts are kind of a mystery right now.
And Percy just keeps telling everybody that he's ill.
Right. But also, it's, you know, Percy's very loyal to his boss, but it's also good for Percy to be in a position to assume his responsibilities.
Right. Again, Slytherin.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So kind of weird. Barty Crouch Sr. is missing. And that's weird because Bertha Jorkins went missing. Just kind of weird.
What I thought was very interesting is that he brings up Bertha Jorkins and asks, is she still missing, you know, kind of what's going on. And I thought that was kind of random for Harry just to bring up.
Well, if you remember his conversation in the fireplace with Sirius.
Right.
Sirius was talking about her. He was like, "I was in school with her. It's bad that she's missing because she was the one who would have known about the Triwizard Tournament and like what was being planned for that." So I think that's probably the only reason that he brings her up.
I think Harry is starting to realize how incompetent the Ministry of Magic is.
And particularly Ludo Bagman. Like he's fun and he's a cool dude, but he's not particularly good at his job.
No, he really isn't really bad at his job.
Yeah. Then Rita Skeeter comes in and it's nothing good. She like tries to get Harry to talk. He refuses to talk to her. He's like, "How could you write that
about?"
Yeah, he yells at her. He's like, "How could you write that about Hagrid?" And then Hermione speaks up and says, she's like really, you know, she butters Harry up. Even when he yells at her, she's like very nice and peachy to him because, you know, she could get something from him. He's somebody who she's nice to him because she wants something from him. She wants another scoop from him because, you know, he's a hot topic of debate in the wizarding world.
Right.
Then Hermione says something and she is like, she turns on a dime and she is very cold and mean to her. It's just interesting.
Yeah, well, in the article, she sorry, just calling back to my book here, getting there, that Draco showed Harry and Ron and, you know, Hermione. Names are hard. There's a line that says, as if this was not enough, the Daily Prophet has now unearthed evidence that Hagrid is not, as he has always pretended, a pure blood wizard. And I thought that the inclusion of pure blood was very interesting, because I could have just been like, oh, he's half giant, you know, and he never said that.
Yeah, blood status was brought into it.
Right. And I thought it just.
And she did that when she mentioned Hermione in the article about Harry.
Right. And so this automatically tells me that you're pretty bigoted. The other thing, I wrote it in my book, but I forgot to include it on my notes, that I wanted to mention about this article was that she brings up that in September of this year, he, Dumbledore, hired Alistair Mad-Eye Moody, the notoriously jinx-happy ex-Auror, to teach defense against the dark arts, a decision that caused many raised eyebrows at the Ministry of Magic. And so I think this is the first inkling that the Ministry is kind of like zooming in on what's happening at Hogwarts and specifically how defense against the dark arts is being taught.
Right, because
and if
next
Dumbledore
year,
is making yeah. the right choices.
Right, because next year they insert their own. Now, I think that has a lot to do with the end of this book as well.
But I think it's starting to brew in Fudge's mind particularly.
Right, and remember, Alistair Moody was like, quote, quote, honorably, like, forcibly retired from the Ministry. They essentially, like, ousted him because they didn't want to deal with him anymore after the war because he was so paranoid. So,
great way yeah. to teach people with PTSD. Apparently the Ministry of Magic doesn't treat their veterans so well either.
We get our first mention of Aberforth Dumbledore in this like weird story about him performing something evil on a goat.
Right. And then Dumbledore is going to mention, this is when Dumbledore mentions.
Oh, this is when they're back at Hagrid's, I guess.
Yeah. So they go back to Hagrid's to try and convince him to take back his position. And as they're banging on the door, and Hermione of all is being very forceful, like, you cannot let this keep you down. She's a terrible person. Like, you just have to rise against. And Dumbledore opens the door to Hagrid's hut and invites them all in.
They're having
tea. And they have tea. And Harry has some, you know, kind of very choice words about the situation. And he's like, oh, I'm sorry, Professor. And I thought it was cute. And Dumbledore's like, I have momentarily lost my hearing, Harry.
Examining Dumbledore has been an enlightening journey throughout this reread. And there are a lot of things about Dumbledore that as an adult are disappointing me, but the quirky one-liners I will never not like.
No, they're so good.
They're really good.
This is a scene particularly where I think Dumbledore shines
yeah.
as a person. And I don't always feel that way about him. I also thought it was funny that when he brings up Aberforth, he mentioned something like, well, I didn't know if he could read.
Yeah.
And Aberforth is like one of the better wizards alive. I mean, he maybe doesn't have as much skill and power as Dumbledore, but we see when he fights in the Battle of Hogwarts that he is like pretty apt at magic.
At least
like,
combat magic. He was allegedly a member of the First Order of the Phoenix. We don't really know in what capacity.
But he's in the picture.
Yeah. I don't know if he's in the picture in the book. We need to get there. Next book.
Yeah, well, we'll see. But I mean, he's no dummy. So I just thought it was like a funny moment of like brother rivalry. And we'll see later on that Aberforth and
that this rivalry goes way deeper than we think it does.
Right. This is a very complicated relationship. But we find a lot of that out after Dumbledore has passed. And so I think it's interesting to get this glimpse from Dumbledore's perspective, because we're not going to get a lot of those.
Right. And they say some nice things to Hagrid, and he, you know, he's feeling a bit better. I just get viscerally angry when people try to mess with Hagrid.
Yeah, because he's just the nicest. He's even like nice to the people who are like so, you know, like he doesn't compromise Draco's quality of education in his class or like what he views as quality of education just because Draco is a jerk.
Yeah.
You know, like he still shows up for all of the students equally.
And he takes, you know, ability level you can debate, but he does take his job very seriously. He wants to do a good job and like show Dumbledore that he's taking it very seriously. And he's just got such a heart for other people. And I just feel so sad that there's somebody who made him think that he was not as wonderful as he is. I get so viscerally angry Can I read one of the ending sections?
Oh my God, I think we highlighted the same. It's probably the same line and it made me tear up.
I'm going to read the whole paragraph.
Okay.
So Hagrid sort of decides to buck up and he's like, you know what? Screw it. I'm going to rise above it. And he's still kind of weepy though. And he looks at Harry and he goes, you know what, Harry, he said, looking up from the photograph of his father. Oh, yes, he's talked about his father and showed them a picture. Very sweet. You know what, Harry, he said, looking up from the photograph of his father, his eyes very bright. When I first met you, you reminded me a bit. Mum and Dad gone, and you was feeling like you wouldn't fit in at Hogwarts, remember? Not sure you were really up to it. And now look at you, Harry, school champion. He looked at Harry for a moment and then said very seriously, you know what I'd love, Harry? I'd love you to win. I really would. It'd show them all. You don't have to be pure blood to do it. You don't have to be ashamed of what you are. It'd show them Dumbledore's the one who's got it right, letting anyone in as long as they can do magic. How are you doing with that egg, Harry? And Harry's like, gulp. Great. Because he hasn't made any progress on the egg. But how could he look in Hagrid's face and tell him that he wasn't doing that. Now he's like, oh, Hagrid, you know, just very sweet that Hagrid is like, has taken so much hope from Harry being champion. Did you highlight something else?
Yeah. It says Hagrid's miserable face broke into a wide, watery smile. That's my boy. You show him, Harry. You show him. Beat them all. That's my boy.
Why didn't Harry name one children?
Probably never heard that line before from a dad.
That's my boy.
That's my boy.
He's looking for... Now, I would argue that Hagrid doesn't necessarily have the... Hagrid, not that he's their peer.
Hagrid considers Harry very much a friend, I think.
Right. They're buddies. But he's also... I wouldn't necessarily say he's like all the time paternal. But he really has Harry's back. Like he's family.
Right. And I think he takes a protector role over Harry very seriously. Yeah. And we see it even when he's carrying Harry's body back from the forest.
Oh my God, I don't want to think about that right now.
It's like he, and the fact that he brought Harry as a baby from Godric's Hollow to the Dursleys, like feels just like a very specific way. And he feels that Dumbledore, I think, has entrusted him with a certain level of care over Harry. And I think, again, Hagrid's not great at boundaries. He's not great at boundaries in a lot of ways. So I think this relationship that is probably meant to be something more like Lupin and Harry, you know, as a professor to a student, has really like broken away to more like friends. But Hagrid also has a huge stake in Harry's protection.
Right.
And just like to say, like,
your older friends.
Right. After looking at the picture of his father and just like reminiscing on what it's like to grow up without parents, and then to hear him say to Harry, like, that's my boy. It just shattered me into a million pieces. And I'm not even somebody who gets like very emotional about Hagrid.
I can confirm that.
But that like really got me, especially just in light of like Sirius is far away for now. And, you know, there's just like so much that
it's very sweet
that just Harry misses out on. And I think of like this, that line really called me to, especially in the movie after Harry's brought Cedric's body back after the last task, and Amos Diggory is shouting like, that's my boy. Oh my. That's my son. And I don't know, what a phrase that could hold so much emotional weight.
You just broke me with that foreshadowing. Oh my gosh. Mind blown. Also heart wrecked. Anyway, this brings us into chapter 25, The Egg and the Eye. This is probably my favorite chapter of the entire book.
Really?
There is so much to unpack in here.
This chapter made me feel layers. Very icky.
It is icky, but it's like when you know the end, there are so many like layers, and like there's so much deception. It reads like something out of like a story like Knives Out, if you've seen the movie Knives Out, where like hidden motives and everybody's hiding something,
and there's a lot of red herrings in this.
Yes.
So I think the conversation with Hagrid gives Harry like this newfound pressure that he needs to figure out what's going on with the egg.
Yes.
But he's sort of dug himself into a hole because he's kind of already told everybody that he's been figuring out the egg and that he's like really close to getting it. And so he decides to finally take up Cedric's advice. And what Cedric had told him was, you know, you might want to take your egg and go for a bath. Like the prefect's bathroom is a wonderful place to kind of clear your mind and bring the egg along with you. So Harry decides to go out and go to the prefect's bathroom in the middle of the night. He puts on his invisibility cloak. He takes the Marauder's map, which I thought was interesting. I guess because it explains in the book. Right. He's trying to know kind of like if Snape and Filch are around the corners, because those are typically the people who are like gunning to catch him out of bed. And he takes his egg to go to the bathroom. And so he gets to the prefect's bathroom.
It's very beautiful. It's described really lovely. Yeah.
Of the prefect's bathroom is some of my favorite in the book. Like, I think you know this about me, like bath time to me is sacred.
Sacred. It's very, very important time.
It's literally like spiritual in my life. Like I have a routine. I have like a very fancy bath caddy to like put my iPad in there to like have a glass of wine with me. Bath time is very important.
McKenna does bath time right.
Oh, yeah,
I need you to like set up a bath time. I've never, you know, you think of things that I don't even think of. I need you to like give me a bath time regimen.
I like go in with my snack. I have a face mask. I like whiten my teeth. I have like a very particular, it's just very important. And so the whole idea that there's this like magical bath at Hogwarts.
It's essentially like a pool.
If I could experience one thing at Hogwarts, I think it would be the prefect's bathroom.
I think mine would be a Quidditch game.
You're such a jock.
I'm like weirdly a little bit of a jock.
Yeah, I know. I knew that when you played competitive water polo.
There you have it, listeners. I was a water polo player. I was a goalie.
So he goes in for the bath, and like you said, yeah, there's a diving board. It's this big, long, rectangular tub, and it has all these spouts.
Yeah, different color taps with different kinds of bubble
baths. There's a jewel in each of them. And yeah, it's all different kinds of bubble baths.
And then there's a big window with in the image of a mermaid. And the mermaid is sleeping.
It's a portrait in the book.
Oh, is it a portrait, not a window?
In the movie, it's stained glass. In the book, it's a
portrait. Oh, that's probably what I'm confusing it with. That makes sense because Moaning Myrtle comes in a second. She mentions that the mermaid is currently asleep when Harry's there. But she's like, oh, when Cedric was here, you know, earlier the mermaid was awake and they were talking. So
she was flipping her portrait. Tail and yeah. So Harry's like having a good romp around the bathtub. It's really like a swimming pool.
I don't know that romp is the correct word.
Like he's just like swimming and having fun and like having fun playing with the taps and the different bubbles.
Well, but yeah, he like swims around a little bit and then he's like, okay, I better get to work. And he grabs the egg and he's sitting in the bath. And what Cedric said was go take a bath, bring your egg, mull it over in the water. And so he's like, okay, so Harry's in the water. The egg is like on the ledge and he's like, I guess I'll try opening it. I don't see how this is going to help. And he opens it and it starts screaming.
Again. Right. And so he's trying to listen. He's like trying to talk to the egg and he's getting quite frustrated. And then finally Moaning Myrtle comes in. She's like, that's not how you do it. That's not how the other boy did it. And he's quite startled.
He's mad. There. He like gets mad.
Which I don't blame him because this is a very creepy sort of exploration of sexuality. Because she's like eyeing him up. He's like, I hope you weren't watching me get undressed, which valid point. And
the 70-year-old ghost.
Right. She says that her eyes were closed. We don't really have, you know, proof that that is true. Nothing about Moaning Myrtle's history, you know, like her track record with Harry shows that she respects boundaries of any sort. So.
Right. And in the movie, the actress sort of, you know, it's very flirtatious what the actress is doing. She's sort of more in the book. It read more of, I mean, she's like giggling because there's a boy, but it's not like, I don't know. She's not like actively going after him. Like we see in the movie, she's still sort of like mopey and.
Right. She does mention that she spied on Cedric until all the bubbles were gone.
Yes.
It's just a little like invasion of privacy. It's just a little creepy. I mean, I know that she like died young and so she's like forever young, but she's not really forever young. It just, it's very like.
No, it is. It's totally creepy. And Harry like rightfully kind of gets upset. He's like, Myrtle, don't look, like, stop, you know. I have a fun fact sort of on this topic of Harry and girls. The author, I don't know if I can say this on our show. The author wanted to write in this book, Harry, like, exploring some more, like, adult things in terms of, like, how he feels about girls. And her editor told her to take it out, and she did.
Interesting.
Yeah. I'm sure it wouldn't have been in this scene, but...
No, I mean, wow.
We don't have to speculate about where it was. I don't want to talk about that. This kid's 14. That seems very, very young.
I don't know that it is young.
For Aaron, it's young. But we don't have to talk about this.
Start having feelings on your own, like, about the opposite sex. Like, and you start thinking about it.
Or not the opposite sex.
Or not the opposite sex. No, that's true. That was kind of close-minded of me. That's,
well, that, I mean, both McKenna and I are, yeah. Anyway.
Yes. I'm thinking from my perspective because I'm heterosexual, but yes, but when you're starting to have feelings for somebody that you're thinking about romantically or sexually, you know, I don't know that maybe you don't act on them at that age, which no judgment if you do or don't or whatever, but I don't think that that's a young age
to start having feelings. No, that makes, no, absolutely. Like freshman year of high school. No, I don't.
You're going to start like picking up at like, I think like age 12, 13, yeah, just raging through you. And all of that is driven by hormones.
Yeah.
So
makes sense.
Interesting little tidbit that you gave us there. Is the scene where they're walking around the campus and they see Crumb jumping into the lake, is that before this or after this? Is that this before this? No, because he would have recognized that it was about the egg. I think it's before he goes to the bath.
I do not remember reading that.
God, we're really prepared today.
I don't remember reading that he saw Crumb jumping in the lake. Maybe that was like, perhaps that was in the Rita Skeeter Scoop chapter. I don't remember. I really don't remember reading that, but I could have just missed it. So basically, Myrtle tells, while you're looking for that, Myrtle tells Harry, oh, Cedric put it in the water. And so Harry's like, okay, I guess. And he puts it in the water and he sticks his head underwater. And did you find it?
So clarification, it is the chapter before. I think when they're on their way to Hogsmeade.
Oh,
they diving into the freezing water and then climbing back up the ship and then diving in again. And at the time they're right. Like, why is he doing this? The water is really cold. But once we know what the second task is going to be, it makes sense that he's practicing going into the water.
I must have just sped through that because I read that. I do remember that now. And I read that part about him swimming. I was like, oh, he's just taking a little polar bear swim in winter.
No, he's already worked out the egg, I think.
Yes. So the song that comes, so when you, the egg is in Mirmish. It's in the mermaid language. The screeching we hear is what Mirmish sounds like above water. So when Harry puts the egg in the water, it comes out as this song. And the words of this, it's a little bit lengthier than we see in the film. It's come and seek us, come see. We cannot sing above the ground. And while you're searching, ponder this, we've taken what you'll sorely miss. An hour long you'll have to look and to recover what we took, but past an hour, the prospect's black, too late it's gone, it won't come back. So he's sitting there and he doesn't know that it's Mirmish yet. He's like, okay, if you can, we cannot sing above the ground. You can't hear the song above ground. It's got to be an aquatic creature. And then he looks at Myrtle. He's like, are there mer people in the lake? He works it out pretty quickly. So he figures out that he's going to have to, you know, go find the mermaids to recover something that was stolen. But then he realizes, he's like, how deep down are they? How long am I going to have to be underwater?
Right.
And that presents a pretty big problem. And then he's talking to Myrtle about breathing and she gets very upset that he missed, because she's like, I haven't breathed in so long. And I guess, yeah, I guess. And then, so Myrtle starts going on this little diatribe about how she died and Olive Hornby, who we'll remember is the girl that used to tease her about her glasses. Right. Apparently, so Harry's like thinking about the task and something else. And while he's thinking, he's not really listening to Myrtle, but we get snippets of her little monologue. She's talking about how Olive Hornby was the one who found her dead body, which like traumatized Olive. And then Myrtle like followed Olive around up until her wedding. like as a ghost, like haunted this girl, Olive Hornby. And then the ministry like mandated her to stay at Hogwarts in that bathroom. So we get a little bit of Myrtle's backstory. And then Harry sees something really weird on the Marauder's map coming back from the bathroom.
Yeah. So he sees.
Yes. It just says Bartimus Crouch.
And he's very confused as to why Bartimus Crouch is in Snape's office.
Yes. This is sort of a, like, the author is sort of reusing what she did in the last book where he sees Peter Pettigrew on the map.
Right. Which is why it's very interesting that Harry's not like, oh, well, maybe Bartimus Crouch is not really here. And maybe this, he doesn't use any of the knowledge of what he had from the last book.
Last year. Yeah, exactly.
To like apply it to this new situation. And so he's very confused because everything he's been told is that Barty Crouch Sr. is very sick and he didn't even go to the Yule Ball, for God's sake. So what is he doing in the middle of the night at Hogwarts, like rummaging through Snape's office?
And Snape doesn't appear to be in there with him. So Harry, instead of going back to the common room, decides to go. He's under his cloak and he decides to go look, which is a mistake because he forgets about the trick step on the stairs. Falls through it. His leg gets, not falls through it completely, but his leg gets stuck in it. And the cloak is like, falls a little bit away. He's able to cover himself again, but the map falls out of his grasp down a couple stairs. And the egg falls down and breaks open, not breaks, but opens up and starts screeching, which alerts Filch and Mrs. Norris. So Filch comes in, sees the egg screeching, closes it up. And his first thought is Peeves must have stolen this from one of the champions and is like messing with it in the middle of the night to try and wake up the castle. And right. Filch is kind of excited because he's always trying to get rid of Peeves. And he's like, if I tell Dumbledore that Peeves was stealing something from one of the students, like he'll definitely get kicked out for sure, which is like, you basically can't kick Peeves out. Like they've tried several times and it hasn't worked. So, all right, McKenna, then.
Well, first, before Filch even shows up, like, can we talk about how Harry did not use the summoning charm to get the map quickly?
Oh, literally. You're right.
Like, he just has, like, the most useless magic skills. I hate to say it, but, like, in any time where, like, the magic he has just learned and performed well would have been useful in this moment, he just, like, never thinks about it or does it. So it's very frustrating as a reader to be like, Harry, what are you doing, my man?
Yeah. Yeah, but you know, it's also plot because there's an important thing that comes up with that next.
So all of a sudden, like, Snape is there.
Yep.
And he's talking with Filch, and then Moody shows up as well.
So Snape is there because someone has broken in to his, like, the potions cabinet in his office that he keeps locked with, like, pretty, you know, powerful magic so that students can't just get in. And he probably has like upped the security on that potions cabinet since Harry's second year when they were stealing from it to make the polyjuice potion. Exactly. And he mentions that he's like, people have stolen from my cabinet before. Yes. And then Moody comes in and we know this is, like I said, this is like a scene in Knives Out where everyone's talking, but they have their own like hidden something.
I know. I want to bring it up in my book because it's all really good.
Do it. We know that Moody can. So Harry's still stuck on the stairs under his cloak while Filch and Snape are having this conversation. And actually before Moody comes in, Snape, you know, Filch has the egg and Snape is like, Potter must be out of bed. Like, Potter's one of the champions because he's like, I've caught Harry Potter out of bed before. That must be his. And then he's like, and he's got his cloak. So he's probably wandering around under his cloak. And Snape's right. He is. Harry's right.
I love that everybody knows Harry has this cloak that allows him to get around the school. And
yeah, like, how does, I bet Snape, it's so, because that section is funny. Because when you read it, you're like, you could be talking about Harry, but this could also be something you probably literally said when you were in school with James. And he's like, he's kind of like Mr. Crocker from the Fairly Odd Parents. He's like, Potter, it's Potter. And he's about to walk up the stairs and literally he would trip over Harry, like stuck in this trip step. And then Moody comes in and kind of stops that from happening. But we know that Moody can see under invisibility cloaks.
Right. And Harry recognizes this. And so he's like, crap,
I'm caught.
Like Moody, but Moody's been cool. Like Moody has been.
He's been covering for Harry.
Right. He's been like nice in the way that only Moody can be nice, but you know, he's been helpful to Harry and interested in Harry's advancement. So he's kind of like, well, because the other thing is that the map is now on the floor and Snape has recognized the map. He knows that the egg. And so he's like, oh, Potter's, you know, obviously out of bed. And Harry's mouthing to Moody and saying like, take the map, take it.
Oh, that's it. That's in a second though. That's when they recognize the paper, because at first they have this
conversation. I love that Moody shows up and says, pajama party, is it?
I wrote that too. It's so funny.
Like, even for being an imposter, he just like hits Moody's like sarcasm so well. That's what
I'm saying. I'm like, when did she decide? I mean, I guess by this point with this, all these red herrings in this chapter, she had decided, but like Moody's character like does not really change between this book when he's an imposter and the next book.
So then Filch says, we were hearing noises. Peeves was throwing things around. And then Professor Snape discovered that someone had broken into his... And Snape says, shut up, like, stop saying, don't say that, to Filch. And then, you know, Moody comes in closer. His magical eye is going crazy. He sees Snape, and then his eye goes to Harry. And so that's when Harry knows, okay, Moody knows that I'm here. And he says, did I hear that correctly, Snape? Someone has broken into your office. And Snape says, it's unimportant. Like, he's keeping it so tight, like trying to, this is just such a fascinating interaction between.
Here's what's so fascinating about it. So if we're from Snape's perspective, so they start talking and Moody, you know, Moody's bringing up like, Moody is essentially implementing Snape in something or like talking about Snape's past. And there's a moment where he grabs his left forearm, ding, ding, ding. So from Snape's perspective, If he thinks he's talking to the real Alistair Moody, and as a former Death Eater, he needs to show that he is actually loyal to Dumbledore. What he doesn't know is he's not actually talking to Moody. He's talking to somebody who used to be a Death Eater with him. And if he says one wrong thing and goes too much into detail about it, suddenly Barty Crouch Jr. knows that he is no longer actually loyal to the Dark Lord.
Right.
So it's a like very interesting interaction, and it's really strategic of Barty Crouch Jr. to implement Snape and like give Harry doubts, because he knows Harry's there, to give Harry doubts about Snape's motive.
Right. And it's just such a good conversation. But Snape says, you know, I've been hiding nothing as you've searched my office pretty thoroughly, which also tells us that now Moody knows the way around Snape's office, right? He knows where things are. He might even know how to get into things, because Snape has probably had to like use his spells to open things up to let Moody go through his stores.
Yes.
It says Moody's face twisted into a smile. I just like wish the scene had been in the movie. Like,
oh, it would have been so cool to watch.
With the actors, like to see Alan Rickman in the scene, to see
Brendan Gleeson.
Yeah, it just would have been so good. And Snape says, Dumbledore happens to trust me.
Yeah, because Moody goes, Dumbledore told me to keep an eye on you. And Snape's like, no, he didn't.
I refuse to believe that he gave you orders to search my office. It's just so good.
And Snape also has to be careful of what he says, because he thinks he's speaking to a former Death Eater. Or I'm sorry, former Death Eater. Former Auror.
Auror.
Yeah. Yeah. So he can't get too cheeky.
No. And Moody says, well, he's a trusting man, isn't he? Believes in second chances. But me, I say there are spots that don't come off, Snape. Spots that never come off. Do you know what I mean? Snape says,
Barty Crouch Jr. is the best actor ever. Give this man an Academy Award.
I know. And the Academy Award goes to Jr. Snape suddenly did something very strange. He seized his left forearm convulsively with his right hand as though something had hurt him.
It's so good. So is it Barty Crouch? Is something that Barty Crouch Jr., like being in proximity to him?
Yes, to somebody who like maybe has an active dark mark, and it's like setting something off in Snape.
So but, why like, doesn't Snape, if that's the case, why doesn't Snape realize that something's up?
Well, he might, but he has to play it cool.
Yeah, because right? Somebody's been in his storage and now there's something going on with his dark mark. So now we know that Snape does have the dark mark, but Harry doesn't know this yet. Harry's like, what is going on? And what are you talking about, spots that don't come off?
What sticks the most in Harry's mind is that Dumbledore is giving Snape a second chance.
And Harry's like, a second chance from what?
Yeah. And so he's like, I want to know what he used his first chance on. And that is going to be a sticking point, you know, as Harry talks to Ron and Hermione and recounts the details of this evening. And so at this point, Snape sees the Marauder's map. He knows.
He recognizes the parchment because Harry hasn't closed the map yet.
No. And he's seen Harry walking around. I mean, of course, it taunted him in the last book, but he recognized this as distinctly something that's Harry's.
Oh, but can we talk about right before? Maybe it is after that. It might be after that. When Moody, like, tells him to go to bed. He's like, get back to bed, Snape. And Snape's like, don't tell me what to do.
Authority to send me anywhere. I have just as much right to prowl the school after dark as you do. It's like such a spitting war from like nothing. And then Harry he's waving furiously at Moody and saying, it's mine, mine. And just as Snape's about to grab it, Moody does what Harry should have done in the first place and says, Accio parchment, so that the map flies into his hand. And then Snape ends up saying, like, I guess I like will go to bed. After he feels around for Harry, can't find Harry. And Moody's like, no, there's nothing here, but I'll be happy to tell Dumbledore how quickly your mind went to implicating Harry Potter.
Yeah, this is really, really tricky territory for Snape, because if he says the wrong thing, if he says the wrong thing that, like, because he thinks he's talking to Moody, who's a former Auror, if he says the wrong thing going one way, Moody, you know, in character, Barty Crouch Jr., Moody in quotes could be like, oh my gosh, you're not trustworthy. You still have Death Eater sympathies. If he says the wrong thing the other way, like saying like, oh, like, because the full extent of his allegiance to Dumbledore is very secret, but like, if he says, you know, a little too much about how loyal he is to Dumbledore, then Barty Crouch Jr. knows he's not on Voldemort's side anymore. Right. But yeah, Snape recognizes the parchment. He's like, oh, it's Harry's. It's Harry Potter's. He's out of bed somewhere. And Moody, you know, yeah, you're right. Moody kind of sends him to bed, and then he sends Filch off. And then what do you say? Best idea you've had all night. Where is it?
Before that, Snape says, I merely thought that if Potter was wandering around after hours again, it's an unfortunate habit of his and he should be stopped for his own safety. And Moody says, ah, I see. Got Potter's best interest at heart, have you? He does. He does really have Harry's. I mean, not because he loves Harry. Not emotionally, but logistically, I mean, he does have Harry's best interest at heart.
And here's my question. When he's saying that, is there something behind that line? Because Barty Crouch Jr. went to school at the time when Snape and Lily were both in school. Does he know about Snape's sort of situation with Lily?
Oh,
and
I'm
therefore
sure.
What his situation would be with Harry?
Because pleaded with Voldemort.
He did that in private.
We don't know. We really don't know the extent of the privacy of that, because Barty Crouch Jr. would have been like pretty high up as a Death Eater. And yeah, he definitely probably is now. And maybe Voldemort has like told him where to keep an eye on people. You don't think Voldemort's curious about Snape?
Oh, and probably.
And like how his relationship to Dumbledore is and what's going on at Hogwarts with, like, I'm sure, you know, Voldemort is like curious about what Snape's been up to and how he's been handling himself, considering how high up of a Death Eater Snape was. Yeah. I don't know. It that line, I think, like, packs a punch.
Yeah, there's so many layers. So then Snape is like, you know, I think I will go to bed. He's just kind of done dealing with, you know, butting heads with Moody. And he goes, best idea you've had all night.
And then, you know, Harry reveals himself to Moody. Filch goes away. Snape goes away.
And Moody is looking at the map because the map's open. He like got it really quick before Snape could get to it. And he's like looking at it. And he's looking at the map and he can probably clearly see that his dot says Bartemius Crouch. And so he asks Harry, he says, did you see with this map who broke into Snape's office? And Harry's like, yeah, really weird. It said Barty Crouch. Like, I thought he was sick. I don't know what he's doing here. If Harry or Snape had taken one more look at that map before Moody got his hands on it, his whole cover would have been blown.
Right.
So knowing this, he asks, can I borrow the map? There's also this line he says to Harry, if there's one thing I hate, it's a Death Eater that walked free. Give this man an Academy Award. He is a Death Eater that walked free, literally.
And
the other thing about that line is it starts to give Harry the inclination of like, was Snape a Death Eater? Like, he doesn't know yet, but he's, the fact that Barty Crouch is casting like trying to put doubt on Snape for Harry is a really, really good cover for him.
It is. And the other cover that is great that he's using is his father. Because before that line, Harry says, Professor Moody, why do you reckon that Mr. Crouch wanted to look around Snape's office? And he says, put it this way, Potter. They say old Mad-Eye is obsessed with catching dark wizards, but I'm nothing, nothing compared to Barty Crouch. So, like, now we have a motive of why Barty Crouch is in Hogwarts. He's there because he suspects something is happening with dark wizards. And
he's in Snape's office. Moody just had this very antagonistic talk with Professor Snape.
And now we've just told Harry, well, if there's one thing I hate, it's a Death Eater that walked free. And we've said that Dumbledore is giving Snape a second chance. So it's like all of the, like, he has planted like the ultimate red herring in this whole situation. Like, he has a suspect and he has somebody who's there to catch the suspect. Like, everything has been orchestrated like so perfectly. And he's just lucky that his dad named him Barty Crouch Jr.
Yeah. Yes, he is. And Harry doesn't really know about Barty Crouch Jr. quite yet. Even if it had said Jr., it just says Barty Crouch.
Right. But it's like a good thing his name wasn't like Douglas Crouch, you know?
Campaign to rename Barty
Paul
Crouch.
Paul Crouch, like.
Chad Crouch. And Moody asks if he can borrow the map. Because if Harry had taken one more look at the map, he would see Barty Crouch standing in front of him.
Right.
And the jig would be up.
So, and Moody's like, oh, this is so, he plays it so well. And then this is like the cherry on top of the interaction.
Mm-hmm.
Harry, who is so desperate for people to believe in him, to have parental figures, to have like guidance and nourishment, like poor orphan Harry, like let's emotionally manipulate him just a little bit more. Moody says to him, you ever thought of a career as an Order Potter? No, said Harry, taken aback. You'll want to consider it, said Moody, nodding and looking at Harry thoughtfully. Yes, indeed. And incidentally, I'm guessing you weren't just taking that egg for a walk tonight. And then Harry leaves this interaction and he's like, and Moody thought Harry ought to be an Auror. Interesting idea. But somehow Harry thought, as he got quietly into his four-poster 10 minutes later, the egg and the cloak now safely back in his trunk, he thought he'd like to check how scarred the rest of them were before he chose it as a career.
And this is his first time thinking about becoming an Auror.
Yeah, this plants the seed. And it's like everything.
Which is funny because it's not even actually from Moody.
Everything we've been told about Aurors is that they're like the badasses of the wizarding community. Like, they're the like elite squad of like dark wizard catchers. Like, this is, you know, the FBI behavioral analysis unit, like in yes. action.
Fun fact, McKenna and I absolutely love Criminal Minds.
We could probably do a whole podcast on Criminal Minds.
We probably could. Maybe we should.
We do like our top 10 like favorite episodes on Patreon or something. There's like a lot to unpack about.
We're working on that, guys. We're gonna get that. We're gonna get that out shortly. The Patreon bringing us into chapter. It's so this past. It's probably my favorite chapter of the whole book. There's so much to unpack. So many hidden motives.
To be honest, like after we leave this chapter, I don't have a ton to say about the second task because, like Quidditch, these task chapters are all action. I think what's important to note is that Harry is like so incredibly lazy, and I just can't even believe he was considering like giving up and just like not showing up to the task because he hasn't figured out how he's going to breathe underwater.
Right. So we need to talk about that. So going into chapter 26, the second task, Harry, you know, Ron and Hermione are trying to help him cram. Well, first of all, he's talking to them about what he witnessed the night before. Mm-hmm. He's like, I want to find out what's going on with Snape. What the heck? That sort of remains a mystery. And then they're trying to help him figure out. He's like, okay, you know, I'm going to have something stolen that I have to get back from the mermaids, and I need to be able to breathe underwater for an hour. And they're all like slaving over books in the library, trying to find something that'll help him breathe underwater for an hour. They clearly have not learned the bubblehead charm yet, because the other two of age champions come up with that probably fairly quickly. And then the night before, Ron and Hermione are with him trying to help him down to the wire. And then Fred comes to fetch them, and he's like, yeah, Professor McGonagall wants you guys. So Hermione and Ron.
Something interesting in this interaction is that Ron says to Harry, have you thought about becoming an animagus?
Yeah.
Which is interesting because that takes like years to build up the skill to do. It's very difficult. And
the spell itself takes an entire month.
And you can't choose which animal you want to be. So like if Harry were to become an owl, like that would not be useful for this task. And then Hermione, you know, obviously brings up about like how you have to register. It's like quite the process to do. But one of the champions is going to use
Transfiguration.
Yeah. And like half works.
Yeah, it works. It works enough.
It works enough to accomplish the goal. But
so at this point, just backtracking a little bit, but I just read a note that I wrote at this point, like how Lupin was to Sirius last year, like before we found out Sirius's innocence, how Lupin was like, you know, their teacher, but also sort of a precautionary measure against Sirius Black coming after Harry. I think, you know, we're meant to think that Moody is like a precautionary measure against either Karkaroff or whatever Snape is up to or was up to. It's sort of, we're sort of getting that parallel. And the only reason I thought of that because they also suggest like, why don't you just attack somebody in front of Alistair Moody and he'll transfigure you and just hope he transfigure you into a submarine, which is funny.
So like you said, Fred and George come to get Ron and Hermione, because what we're about to learn is that each one of the champions has had a person that means some, like, the most important person to them taken to the bottom of the lake, and that's who they have to retrieve. Who would have been down there for Harry if him and Ron had not made up at this point?
I would say Hermione, but she was down there for Crumb.
It also is such a sad statement on Crumb and just like how lonely fame and importance can be, that this like girl who doesn't really like him that much, but they've kind of like mildly connected and have only known each other.
Yeah, they just haven't known each other very long.
Is like the person who's down at the bottom of the lake for them.
Poor Victor.
And then Cho and Cedric, yeah. Like a statement on young love.
Yeah. And then Fleur's sister. Tracking one.
Do you imagine if Hagrid was at the bottom of the lake for Harry?
Oh my god, that's probably who it would have been.
How heavy
would have been really tough to get him back to the surface. Oh, sweet Hagrid. Speaking of Hagrid, two things before the night before. I'm backtracking again. Sorry, I'm out of order. They get another letter from Sirius. He's asking for the next Hogsmeade weekend. And Harry is like kind of upset that his letter only says, tell me when the next Hogsmeade weekend is. He's sort of really craving Sirius's guidance, especially since he's so stressed about the second task. And then they see Hagrid. He has gone back to Care of Magical Creatures, and he continued with the unicorn thing after Grubbly Plank, and he's got two unicorn foals, and they're like gold, which is cool. Okay, then continuing back to the night before, Ron and Hermione go away. Harry goes back to the common room. He's like by himself trying to read more books.
Yeah, he takes a huge stack of books. He's up till like 2 a.m.
And then he's like, screw it. I'm going to go back to the library. He goes back to the library under his cloak and is reading more books.
And he's not encountering anything that would be helpful. And so he starts to have doubts about him even competing. Should he just show up and tell them he couldn't figure it out and he can't compete in the task? And so he falls asleep with these thoughts in his head. And when he's woken up, it's by none other than our friend Dobby.
Oh, Dobby.
Who wakes him up 10 minutes before the challenge is supposed to start, which I don't even know how you're supposed to run from the Gryffindor common room all the way down.
The library.
Oh, the library, all the way down to the Black Lake. Also, interesting that Dobby knew where to look for Harry, and I would say that's because Moody has the map.
Ah, correct.
And Dobby has...
Dobby comes in and basically just saves the day, very last minute, and it's kind of... Harry does not have time to think about how sketchy this is. Dobby shows up. He says, you've got the task in 10 minutes. Here's something that's going to help you breathe underwater for an hour. And Ron is down there at the bottom of the lake and you have to go get him. Right. Dobby knows all this stuff and just shows up and is very helpful. And again, Harry does not have time to think, this is kind of weird that you know all of this.
So he shows up just in time to... get in the lake and to...
Percy is there for Barty Crouch Sr.
Yes.
Judging. He's continuing to take Barty Crouch Sr.'s place. Harry is like very ill prepared. Everyone else is like in swim attire. Harry's literally in his robes. So he like takes off his shoes and socks and just like climbs into the lake in his robes.
And
Dobby has given him gillyweed.
Yeah.
So this is different from the film because Neville would have told him about it. And this time, and I think Neville gave it to him in the film. This time Dobby gave it to him. Yes.
So Harry takes the gillyweed. It gives him gills. He goes into the water. All of a sudden it's not cold. He feels, you know, so light and great.
He can breathe underwater.
Kind of like swimming, like, where do I go? Moaning Myrtle shows up again and directs him in the right direction. He swims down. He sees the people. He gets
attacked a little bit by a Grindylow, but fends it off because Professor Lupin prepared them for Grindylows.
So he gets down to where the people have been held. He kind of sees who's there for everyone. And he, like, can't stomach leaving all of them there and
Ron. He has somehow, because of the song, gotten the impression that if anybody gets left there, they're going to die. Which logically, Dumbledore would not let another student.
We see that Dumbledore has a good relationship to the Mer people. They pay tribute to him at his funeral. He has a conversation with the leader of the Mer people after the task to kind of hear about Harry's actions down at the bottom of the lake. But Harry doesn't know that. All Harry's going off of is this clue. And they've also told him that this is an incredibly dangerous tournament and people die.
And the mermaids are kind of scary and a little bit, you know, they're kind of like holding Harry back and like laughing at him, a little bit threatening. What's kind of funny is when he gets down to like their city under the lake, they like have homes and gardens and like one of them has a pet Grindylow like on a leash in the front yard. It's just kind of funny. It's funny imagery.
So essentially Cedric comes for Cho, Victor comes for Hermione. Nobody shows up for Gabrielle. For Fleur's sister, because she couldn't make it past. And
he's talking to one merman and it says the merman has like a string of shark fangs around his neck. Isn't this fresh water?
Yeah, weird.
Are there freshwater sharks? Am I crazy? Continue. Anyway,
I don't know. If there's any shark people in the comments, please let us know.
Listening, yeah.
And so struggle ensues. Harry ends up being able to take both Gabrielle and Ron back up to the surface of the water, but he's past the time limit. So he automatically thinks like, well, that's it. All of this trouble for nothing. And like, I still didn't, you know.
And Ron kind of gives him some flack for it. He's like, Harry's like, what was I supposed to do? Leave you down there? And he's like, yeah, like Dumbledore was not going to let one of us like
die.
Drown down and just stay down there. Like, what were you thinking?
And
took the egg very literally. And there's a very sweet moment where Ron gets out of the water. And I don't know when it is that Percy realized that Ron was going to be the one in the water. Maybe when Cedric came out and had Cho and Percy realized it was a person and thought, oh, if Harry's going down there, it's definitely going to be Ron that he's going after. And he like runs into the water after Ron and like gives him a big hug. It's very
sweet. It is really
It's like
sweet.
Very worried for Ron. And Dumbledore's speaking to the merpeople because they sort of followed Harry out in like a procession after he like threatened them with his wand. And then they speak very highly of him to Dumbledore, and he ends up getting second place in the task. Cedric got first place, but now since he got, I think he tied for first in the first task, now he's like tied with Cedric for first place overall, which is crazy. And Fleur's all happy that he brought back her sister.
Kisses Ron on the cheek, and Hermione gets jealous. And it, like, while this is happening, Crumb is trying to
talk to Hermione
and but get she's her focused attention.
On Harry. And then the third task is coming up June 24th.
Right. So he has quite a while to get prepared, and they're going to let them know a month before kind of like what they need to be prepared for. It's also important to note that we get this Hermione trying to swat a water beetle out of her head. So if you remember the beetle.
Oh,
yeah.
I didn't even pick that up.
Yeah. So that's Rita again in her animagus form.
Spoiler. It's fine. We already talked about it.
And yeah, that's kind of all I have here. I think it's just important to like notice the theme that like Harry is always trying to save people. We're going to see it at the end of this book when he just like, he has to bring Cedric's body back, which is absolutely the right thing to do. No, but it just shows like, I don't know, Harry's like moral compass.
Right. And I think, you know, if we're going to like dig a little deeper on the fact that he thought people were going to die and was like trying to prevent that, I, you know, when he steps back and looks at it logically and how like Dumbledore is sort of in charge of this because he's the one communicating with the mermaids, like, of course Dumbledore wasn't going to leave any students down at the bottom of the lake if their champion couldn't come get them. But like, it's not very far-fetched for Harry to assume that like a student is going to be in mortal danger, because right. he has been in mortal danger since he got to Hogwarts and since he figured out his like past. So I don't think it's far-fetched for him to jump to that conclusion that like somebody's going to die if I don't do something.
Right. And it just shows a lot about who Harry is. I mean, when he thinks Sirius is in trouble at the Department of Mysteries, he's going to go to his rescue. And this is just it's you almost wonder if Voldemort got the idea to manipulate Harry in that way because of what he would have heard about the way the Triwizard tournament went.
Oh yeah, maybe. I don't know who would have been reported back to him. I don't know if Barty Crouch Jr.'s like reporting back. Yeah, if he's like taking the risk of trying to communicate. But you know, Voldemort is very proficient in occlumency. So I had this thought after, you know, going through that 24th chapter, the 23rd chapter again? No. What chapter were we on? Where not this last one, the one before.
25.
Chapter 25, when they're like on the staircase. Like, if that had gone slightly awry for Moody, Harry could have ended up dead that night.
Right.
Like, if he took one more peek at the map, Moody could have just, you know, just killed him to keep his cover. Although that right. was the reason for the cover in the first place, so I don't know. But like if it had gone, if there had been any hitch in what happened, Harry could have been dead or captured or something crazy.
Yeah, I mean, Harry is just like always like one step
ahead of the bread line.
Yeah.
So those are our chapters.
Good talk.
Very fun.
And we'll see you next week for 27, 28, 29.
Yes.
Next chapter is Padfoot Returns. So
my favorite.
Something like so left out of the movie, by the way.
Yeah, we don't see Sirius at all in the fourth movie except for in the fireplace.
Fire. Yeah.
Yep, that's it. Thank you for joining us for McKenna's birthday episode, and we'll see you guys next week.
Hey, thanks for listening to our latest episode. As always, please subscribe on whatever podcast platform you're listening on. And if you're not a listener on Apple Podcasts, it would still help us out a lot if you head over to Apple Podcasts and leave us a 5-star review. If you have any questions, comments, concerns about anything you heard in this episode today, please drop us a line at our Anchor profile. You can leave us a nifty little voice message there, or you can head to our Instagram @thedailyprofcast to DM us or leave us an email.